Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Tim Hutton, and I'm the communications director for Zenvo Automotive. And I've been in and around the car industry for, I guess, 25 years now, which is quite scary. Putting a number against it.
The Driven Chat Podcast, powered by Paramex Digital.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's Driven Chat Podcast. My name is John Markar, and as you have just heard there from the introduction, this week we are joined by a Mr. Tim Hutton. Hello, Tim Hutton.
Hello there. Good to see you again, John.
Good to see you. Now, I feel it would be important to put a little bit of a disclaimer on the beginning of this episode, as I have done once or twice before in the series of episodes that we've put out thus far, and that is that our guest this week, Mr. Tim Hutton, is quite a good friend of mine. And whilst we will be talking about all sorts of very official things along the routes of what you do for a career, both past and present, there might be a bit of friendly chat in this that you, dear listener, are just going to have to put up with, because that's the way it rolls. But we worked out before we started recording that Tim and I first met, and it's a good first meeting, we met 2008, which is quite terrifyingly 15 years ago, in the Nürburgring car park, if my memory serves me correctly. I was standing with another good friend of ours, Mr. Alistair Clark, film director extraordinaire. And Alistair was there to do some work and said, I've got this guy coming who's a motoring journalist and is road testing quite a cool car, and enrolls this rather fantastic looking, then brand new, 2008 Aston Martin V8 Vantage, which I remember impressed me for a number of reasons. The colour was good, and it also had the pop-up Bang & Olufsen stereo system. And I thought, God, this guy must be doing really well if he's getting Aston Martin press cars. Was I right?
No. Not at all. No. Very much champagne lifestyle, lemonade budgets.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that had taken a lot of sweet talking with the then press officer there, Kim Palmer, who's gone on to great things across the industry now himself. I think I worked on him for about 2 or 3 months, assuring him that the magazine that we were working on was legitimate and that it was a great idea to let me put a few thousand miles on Aston Martin, driving it to the Nordschleife. not driving it around the track because we weren't allowed to do that, but no. We did. And
I think enough time's passed now where
yeah.
That doesn't matter anymore.
No, it's fine. And yeah, met you guys in the car park. I think I'd been chatting to Al ahead of the trip because I'd seen some of his work and just said it'd be really cool to get together while we're there to get some content.
Just like that, folks, that's where you meet cool people. We've both met quite a few cool people at the Nürburgring, haven't we? It's a good place. It's one of those spots in the world where I think, well, it's probably unrivaled by any other location where you're quite likely to meet somebody who's like-minded, who has similar, if not slightly more ambitious, destiny in life, and people that spend far too much money on cars, which is fine, I believe.
Yeah. I think all the interesting people that I've met in life and all the opportunities have just come from just being out there and doing stuff.
Yeah.
And doing what you enjoy. And off the back of that, that's where you make good friends for life, I think. So the ring was completely new to me then. You guys were pretty seasoned to it already then. Mm. But it was a cool place, very exciting. And it was late November. It was a RMA track day. And I think it was probably the day after they'd had a VLN race. So the track was cold, greasy, covered in leaves.
Oh my God, it could actually be 15 years to the day that we met.
Yeah.
If not the day, it's certainly within a week.
Yeah. It would have been November, I reckon.
How weird.
Whatever the last race of the season was, I guess. I think maybe the track's closed now, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, really interesting bunch of people. And yeah, you go out and you have pizza and you have your steak on a stone and conversations start. And yeah, I probably fed you a load of rubbish and you thought,
This guy's got it going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we will get to that point, I think. That's a nice little opener. It's the kind of the scene setting for the book, isn't it? They met at the motorsport circuit. But let's go back to the bits where before we met. And as you know, because I know you've listened to a few of these episodes, one of the questions I always like to start with is asking that question about the core memory, something as far back as you can remember, either as a small child or as a young adult, something that might have happened or a sequence of things that might have happened that's ultimately got you to where you are now or switched on that little pilot light of excitement in and around the world of cars.
Yeah, well, I think my earliest living memory is in the back of my mum's little Fiat 500.
Mm-hmm.
So my very first memory is car related.
Wow.
And I have a terrible memory, so it's quite impressive that I can even remember anything. And then the formulative stuff really would be the fact that I had two older brothers, 8 years older and 16 years older, both into their cars, a father who was into his cars, a mother that used to ride motorbikes, not so into cars, and thoroughly disappointed that we had a third boy. She'd already teed up the name Holly because I was a Christmas baby, so she was hoping that I was going to become a ballet dancer, which she did make me do for a little bit.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's all gone now, sadly. So, but we had two children's race cars that were built by some guys that were ex-Allen Man Racing, and we used to go down to Tangmere Airfield after my dad would get back from work and drive them around the airfield.
Nice.
So the first time I drove in, I think, was 7 years old, I think, 6 or 7.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
It's a good 10 years ahead of most people, isn't it?
Yeah. And they're just lawnmower powered cars with torque converters, so no gears or anything, but all rose jointed suspension, styled like a 60s Grand Prix car. And yeah, tearing around airfields until it got dark, which you can't do that anymore. So yeah, there was no hope.
The if the seed, so if it wasn't the Fiat 500 that did it, it would have been some excited. Well, it sounds like excitable dad going, right, have a go at this. And I can't imagine that would have been too much of a difficult persuasion.
No. My brothers had done it. And when they had been driving the cars, you could go up to Goodwood in the evening and drive there till it got dark.
Oh, wow.
Free of charge.
Yeah. Worth pointing out, actually, isn't it, that you grew up stone's throw from the circuit.
Yeah, I grew up in Chichester. After school, I would ride up to the circuit. And back then, because I'm old, there was still the odd F1 team testing a bit of aero around Goodwood before it would go to a European Grand Prix. So, yeah, it's a pretty cool place to grow up in. And at the weekend, you'd jump in your brother's Nova GTE or his or Lancia Delta HF Turbo, go up to Goodwood and watch people doing track days.
Nice.
And that was nearly always a weekend occurrence, and from time to time they would do track days and my dad would do track days, and
cool,
just grew up around it. Yeah, so it was just cars. That's all that was going on in my life.
Mega. Well, the other question that I often like to ask is in relation to the car that you've driven here in. However, we're actually sat in your front room, so you've not driven anything here, but let's imagine we've met somewhere. What would the car have been that you turned up in?
Well, I mean, if we're talking kind of what would the car have been, it would have been the Jaguar Mark II.
Yes.
I have, but that has sadly been off the road since we blew the engine up in Portugal. So it would be the Z4 Coupe, which I've just recently picked up for a nice little winter runabout, basically.
Yeah.
Winter tyres going on it next week.
Very cool.
And try and get down to Switzerland before Christmas, see some friends.
That'd be really cool. Yeah, first time I've seen it. I've just pulled up in the car park in a very enormous, very muddy Land Rover Defender. And it's dwarfed the little Z4, but they are such cool things. Really cool little car. And the coupe version as well, which of course makes everything cooler. Yes. Coupes over convertibles, always the way. So, difficult one to know where to start. It's actually made more challenging when talking to a friend, because there's loads of things that I do know. But of course, in the art of painting the picture for the podcast, we need to go through it in a more organic interview way. So talk to me about the kind of early years of your work in the automotive world, because I think most people that know you now will know you for your work with Zenvo. A lot will know you for your magazine life, both as a writer, as an editor, as an owner of magazines, as a creator of magazines. But there was a time beforehand, wasn't there, where it wasn't so much about writing the words and taking the photos, it was more about doing the layout stuff. So why don't you tell us, where did you start and how did it then form into automotive?
Yeah, so I did graphic design at college, and in the summer I was freelancing in London at a design agency that my middle brother was working at, and they were called MPA Fingal, and the MPA stood for Motoring Press Agency, and they had originally been founded with Jeremy Clarkson as part of the founders.
Oh, right, okay.
And everything they did basically was car-related. So in that summer, I was working on a logo for the Chinese World Rally Championship. I think we did some postcards for Honda for British Touring Car Championship to hand out at races. Everything. It was just all car related, and I loved it because I like design and being creative as well. And yeah, I started back at college that autumn, and then they got in touch and they said, do you want to come and work for us? Nice. So didn't even think about it. Pied off the education. I hated school. College was way more enjoyable because you're allowed to be yourself and be a bit free. Mm. But school and its structure didn't agree with me. So, took the job in London and started commuting 2 hours each way up to London every day. I just loved it. Loved all the work. Loved being around creative people. Loved being in London.
Mm.
And every week, one of the directors, Matthew Carter, who's a a motoring journalist himself, he would turn up to work in a new car. Mm-hmm. And after about half a year of this, I just kind of said, look, what's going on?
What's the deal?
Yeah. And he said, well, I write about cars, and the manufacturer gives me a car every week to review.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Nice. And yeah, started thinking about that. And then one week a Ferrari Daytona got delivered, and it was from the heritage fleet of Ferrari, I guess maybe from Italy, and they'd loaned it to him to go and do a rally for an article.
Wow.
And I just thought at that point, I need to get in on this. but I'd completely fluffed school, hated writing, was rubbish at English. And so I thought, well, the only way that I can do this one day is to maybe produce a magazine, because I can do all the design side of things. Mm-hmm. So from an early stage, this was early 2000s, I was thinking about magazine design. And I left the agency, went freelance for a bit, and then did some freelance for a magazine called Intersection, which mm-hmm. was a really nice magazine. The guy there, Yorgo, was he said, we can't pay you anything, but you can by all means come and work for us before Christmas and learn. And while I was there, he had a Gumball Rally trophy on the cabinet.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, cool, Gumball. Yeah, I've seen a couple of programs about it.
Yeah, bear in mind, so this is early 2000s. Gumball started in 99, didn't it? So it's still in its very much its infancy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This was, this was 2003 or 4. Mm-hmm. So I'd seen the 2003 film San Francisco to Miami, which they released in the cinema, a couple of things. And also 2004, me and a bunch of friends jumped in a car and drove to Paris to watch the start there. So we were kind of super fans. late 2003, working for nothing for this magazine. And he said, well, I'm going out at Christmas to Monaco to see Max. And I think he's looking for a designer, so I can put in a word for you if you want.
Nice.
I was like, cool, yeah, wow, he's in Monaco, like, yeah. He must be cool. Similar situation to when you first met me, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. Similar introduction to Gumball as well, but we'll get to that chapter later, I'm sure.
The next, beginning of the next year, Max called up and I went and had an interview with them when they were still in Notting Hill, in the office was his flat.
Yeah.
And, took the job. Quite a pay cut. But yeah, it was still kind of rock and roll then. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So you've gone from, did the kind of magazine aspiration dwindle a little bit, or was it just kind of like put on pause as this is something that's so cool that I just have to be part of it?
Yeah, I couldn't see any way of doing the magazine at that point. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to be more and more around cars and being creative. And so Gumball offered me a chance to push the balance towards more cars and less creativity rather than going into a design agency, doing all creative stuff, but about cars. So it got me closer to cars. Mm. And I think I needed a bit of wildness in my life. I'm very reserved, shy, nervous person, so I needed that.
It's an interesting one as well, and I think it's important to kind of paint the picture for any of our listeners below a certain age, so I'm going to say even maybe below 30. You've got to think back to early 2000s, 2004-5. Social media is not really a thing yet. YouTube isn't a thing. We're not constantly bombarded or shown the world's most exclusive supercars and hypercars at our disposal by picking up our mobile phones. A lot of people didn't even have a mobile phone. You know, the internet was in its infancy and it was a bit rubbish. So an opportunity like get involved with this brand Gumball. And again, I think a lot of people think now they kind of take Gumball for granted because there are so many of these like copycat rally companies now doing a similar thing. Oh, let's put on this glamorous rally where we go from one country to another via five others and this, that, the other. Gumball was so far ahead of everybody else. It was the most rock and roll, unusual, mad thing. Like Jackass were on it 1 year and David Hasselhoff drives it every year. And it was just mad to think that that was something that a reserved car nerd might have some sort of involvement in. But it was the case, wasn't it?
Yeah, I wanted to grow as a person, and you have to kind of push yourself out of your little bubbles, really. And being in London did that, I think. And yeah, the guys who I worked in the office with were just real characters. And we'd get, like, one day we had a limo pull up, two women in their underwear got out of the car and gave us an invite to a party at the top of Centre Point, like, that night. And just random stuff would happen. People would come round knocking, asking for money for things that hadn't been paid for. On the rally, you've got people related to Count Dracula. You've got art dealers, celebs. It was wild kind of proper wacky races stuff. Yeah. And it was fun and exciting. And Max's friend network was great. So if we needed to do photos, you'd have Jody Kidd coming over in a Murcielago and all manner of just excitement. And I just, yeah, that was quite addictive. Mm. And I'm sure you know how easy it is to get caught up in that Gumball moment. It's infectious.
It is. Yeah, it is. Because, yes, a good few years later, I got a call from Tim saying, just had a chat with Max and he's looking for a new events guy and I might put your name forward. And that happened. But we'll get to that bit. So you did a little stint at Gumball. It was a year or two, was it?
So it was 2005 rally I did all the design work for.
Mm-hmm.
And then started to work on the 2006 stuff. And then I think I worked the start of the 2006 rally, which was the crazy around the world in 8 days, three continents.
Is that the one where they went to North Korea?
No, they drove through Europe, then they flew the cars to Asia, drove across Thailand, then flew the cars to Salt Lake City, and then ended up in LA.
Right.
So in 8 days, and once you're on the Gumball, you just lose all track of time, what country you're in, anything.
Yeah.
And it's just adrenaline keeping you going. And then at the end of Gumball, you're ill for about 3 weeks because you're just, your body needs to recuperate, basically. So yeah, I think I was still doing bits for them. I worked the 2007 rally start as well. But I was back to doing freelance design work by then, just because London was so expensive to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the job wasn't gonna kind of grow enough. I just thought it might be a bit of a bad idea if I stay here too long, because there's nowhere to level up if you're the head of design and
there's
a small team. So I needed to spread my wings.
Fair enough. So what did that involve? How far from that point, from like that mad chapter of Gumball, did you get to getting the first press cars delivered? Was it a straightforward soon after thing, or did that come a lot later?
So 2007, I found myself working in Tunbridge Wells for an ad agency, doing a lot of Honda stuff. And then I left there, and I think I won a competition to have like a Peugeot something for 48 hours.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, cool. And it kind of rejigged my memory of getting cars and things.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, I never had the money to have anything nice myself. I mean, I'd had my first car was a Citroen AX GT, which was, that was a cool first car.
That's pretty cool, yeah.
But then after that, the cars I was driving up to London in were ridiculous. So, for example, I accidentally bought an Audi.
Okay, as one does.
How do you accidentally buy an Audi? Well, you go to your local car auction place on an industrial estate, and you and your mates, after you've had your fry up the morning after, walking around kicking tyres, and there's this Audi coupe 2.2 in there, so looks a bit like a quattro, but
yeah,
not four-wheel drive or anything. And I just went up to the lady and I said, oh, how much are they looking for on that? And she was like, oh, I think like £375.
Very good.
And I was like, oh, cool. I was like, do you reckon they'd take like £295 or something like that for it? Just very casually. Yeah. And then we walked off and we were walking around and she came over and she was like, yeah, no, they would. I was like, oh, cool, I'll have a think about it. And she's like, well, no, you've made an offer now, so you're legally bound to buy it.
Oh, right.
I was like, ah.
Oh.
Okay. Can I borrow some money? So I was driving that up to Parsons Green every day, putting a litre of oil in it every morning as I put 20 quid's worth of fuel in it.
Perfect.
Because it was just falling out of the car.
Wow.
Yeah. And that had a neat thing that if your mate in the passenger seat really stuck his foot deep into the footwell, the car would break as well. So that was a great amusement for them. So, yeah, off piste a bit there. But,
that's all right.
But yeah, basically, it was quite nice having a new car for 48 hours.
Yeah.
And I said to my girlfriend at the time, let's go for a road trip. Mm. So we... I basically wanted to do as many miles as I could in this thing. So we drove out of West Sussex, drove to Blackpool, didn't stay there very long. Not really my vibe. I'm sure some people love it.
I'm sure they do.
Yeah. But it wasn't for me. And then drove up to Edinburgh.
Good work.
Around Edinburgh. And then decided that what I'd really like to do is go and see Gateshead Car Park, just south of Newcastle, which is the car park used in the film Get Carter.
Uh-huh.
And it's a real brutalist car park. I don't think it's even there anymore. So, yeah, by about 4 a.m. we're driving through Newcastle. And then...
Girlfriend at the time happy with this or a bit bemused by the activity?
I think the novelty was wearing off by then. Yeah, and then from Gateshead, we drove into the North Yorkshire Moors, and my dad had done some drawings of Whitby years ago, and I was like, oh, let's drive to Whitby. And then I think we drove to Scarborough as well. It was getting light by then. Pulled over, had half an hour kip, because I was getting a bit tired by then, and then drove home. So I can't remember how many miles that was, but...
I'd like to think that whoever... received the car back, if they had to do, like nowadays we have press cars delivered that you get the clock in and clock out sheets, certainly when they're like, I'll just record the mileage. Oh, you've done fairly well, you've done 2,000 miles. I like the idea of somebody getting in that car going, sorry, you had this for how long? And you've done what?
Yeah, it was a stupid idea, really. But anyway, it happened. And so after that, I started to think about the magazine stuff. I'd quit the job in the design agency in Tunbridge Wells. Was just working from home, chipping away, doing freelance. And when you've got a lot of time on your hands, your brain wanders. Mm. So I came up with this concept for a magazine called Road.
Yeah.
And I got introduced to a guy called Phil Raby, who's now a Porsche dealer, selling very nice cars down the South Coast. At the time, he was working for Porsche 911 World, and he was local. So I went and chatted to him about doing magazines and this idea of producing a online page-turny type magazine,
because
mm-hmm. The technology was kind of...
It was just at that point, wasn't it, where suddenly there were... electronic versions of all the magazines that we could go and buy in the shop, but also we started to see new publications coming forward and companies were using it as brochure software. Mm. Look at our products we've got for sale, don't get a hard copy, look at it on our website.
Yeah.
So yeah, exciting times.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, hindsight, the trying to read something traditional on modern technology is ridiculous, because yeah, a well-built website will do that so much better.
Yeah,
but yeah, there you go. Anyway, I kind of thought, well, this is a way to produce a magazine without needing the budgets to print and manufacture and post out magazines. So he then introduced me to another Phil called Phil Royal, who had written for a few of the tuning mags. And we kind of got together and started working through our contacts and pulling together a dummy online magazine. And I think, early 2008, we did the first issue of that. And we were trying to do it quarterly, I think, or maybe every 2 months. I think the first one was about 60 pages. We got a few adverts in there, but we needed to get the manufacturers and the brands behind us. We didn't have an ad salesperson. So
I can imagine that was quite a task as well. You know, as I'm sure everyone now knows, magazines don't make money by selling copies. They make money by placing adverts. So the idea of phoning up a company and going, "Hi, I've never done sales before, but can we have some money in order to do this magazine, which you've never heard of, which is new, but we hope will be big." That must have been quite the task.
Very, very difficult. And also 2007, we'd had a bit of a financial crash. So people weren't really being that frivolous with their budgets. So it was tough, and we just kind of were like, well, we can produce this cheaply. We can still be doing other stuff on the side to fund putting a bit of time into doing this. So we just kind of cracked on. So I think my first press car, I'm trying to think what it would have been. I think it was a Nissan 350Z, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And straight away, I was just totally hooked.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just loved the fact that somebody is turning up with the keys, full tank of fuel, go and drop them off at the station if they need a lift or whatever. Yeah. I've always been kind of super polite to these people that do that job, because it's not a great paying job. And
no,
driving something down very sensibly, because you can't lose your job, and then taking a train all the way back again is not good. So you can't leave them to walk kind of two miles down a lane or anything. I think it was 350Z. And we gradually over time started to build up a bit of momentum. And it started growing, and we were getting a bit of a following, getting some positive comments on places like Piston Heads, which was surprising.
Yeah.
And then a couple of guys by the names of Chris Harris, Jethro Bovingdon, and Richard Meaden, little known to me, had also been doing something exactly the same, but with great writing and video content and more budgets, called Drivers Republic.
Yeah, of course.
Which launched around the same time. And very hard to compete with them, because it just had beautiful photography, nice design production, and some budget.
They had a huge budget behind it, didn't they? They had somebody in as a...
They had an investor who, was a bit of a tricky character. We worked with him a little bit later on, after everything went wrong with Drivers Republic. He launched his own thing called Skidmark.
Brilliant.
Which
did as well as the name, I'm sure.
That was hilarious, the kind of stuff going around when he launched that. Just setting yourself up for it, really, aren't you? The magazine grew, and it allowed me to kind of start traveling and getting into press cars and doing stuff like going up to the Nürburgring. That was the biggest thing I had done to that date when I met you.
Oh, cool.
Because everything, we had to pay for it all out of our pockets. Yeah. And the minute you start driving through Europe, it gets expensive with fuel and accommodation. Mm-hmm. I think I was being put up at a guy called Jaco Velder, his house, slept in his roof, I think, on a mattress. We managed to...
I thought you were at the Doran.
So, because I offered you a room there, I think.
Yeah.
So we had managed to negotiate rooms in the Doran. And then at the last minute, Bill number two had negotiated rooms at the Tiergarten.
That's right. Pistol yeah. class. That's where Al and I stayed.
Yeah. So we were staying there. So we had this spare room in the Dorrent, which I think one of you guys was maybe going to stick around. Or maybe that was when Al's yellow hairy canary blew up. And he was maybe thinking of staying another day. I can't remember. That might have been another trip.
I think that was another trip, yeah.
That was, yeah.
I can't remember what we drove out in.
Actually, I think that was the time I met Julian Smith and had a drift lap around the Nordschleife, which is
right. Yes.
Pretty wild.
Also remember that.
So yeah, road carried on for quite a while until one of the guys kind of really got into a new relationship with a chick and just got distracted, basically.
Okay.
And the magazine just ground to a halt, but we'd it would been a struggle, and we were kind of self-funding it. So
it's difficult as well, isn't it? Yeah, the self-funding is a huge thing, but when it's essentially a group of friends trying to get something together, if you haven't got that kind of corporate lead somewhere in the organisation to keep everything churning along and keep it processing, it is difficult. And these sort of things happen. You know, you fall out of love with it, and you go, oh, it might be easier to just go off and do something else then.
Yeah. Well, I parked road. And then once everyone was out of it, I tried to relaunch it titled Stiff Magazine.
I remember well, yes.
The idea of the title was to just create a bit of conversation.
Not quite as good as Skidmark, let's be honest.
It's not as good as Skidmark and certainly quite a confusing name, really. Yeah. But I had a whole load of content that we hadn't used. And I think the first thing that you and I did together is I had a CSL and a...
Yes, that's right.
E90, 92
yep.
edition. And we met up at either yours or
yep.
Al's parents. And we drove into London to do a little film.
We did.
Yeah. And on the way there, I think... Al got pulled over in the CSL.
Yes, he did. Yeah, he did.
So he got pulled over because they were like, "It's a very nice car that you're driving this evening, sir." I avoided another police car coming and managed to curb the black wheels on this brand new M3 edition. So it was not going particularly well. But
good start for the BMW press office back then.
Yeah, who were also expecting this all to go out in a magazine called Road Magazine as well. So,
of course, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, we worked our way up to West London and yeah, I think it must have been very, very slippery around Piccadilly Circus.
It was, from memory, there was a diesel on the road or something.
Something happened and...
We lost the back end of the cars.
Yeah, it was almost, yeah, I mean, I think I wrote a letter saying you need to watch that. Westminster Council, that's dangerous.
Yeah, somebody might get hurt.
Yeah.
But yeah, the result of which... also resulted in our first little film.
Yeah.
Produced and filmed, well, produced by Al, filmed a bit by Al, a bit by me, probably a bit by you. It was very much a throw it all together at once. I seem to remember I was driving around in a Lupo Sport 16 valve.
Nice.
Don't mean to brag. And we were using that as a tracking car with me driving through Shad Thames and Al Clark sitting in the boot, an open boot of a Lupo Sport,
yeah,
filming the E90 and then the CSL driving through Shad Thames.
Yeah, well, Al was very much the Dennis Waterman of the film world at that point and had to do everything himself. So,
yeah, that's right.
Wrote the theme tune, sang the theme tune. That was our first little film. It was a cool film, actually.
It is. It's still out there. I will provide a link to it in the description below.
Yeah.
Because it's worth a watch.
Yeah.
It is. It was early stages of me being involved in this world, for sure. Early stages of Al Clark doing Al Clark things. And the how many issues of Stiff went out? Was it just the one? Were there a couple?
No, we did a few. And this young lad called John Slavin got in contact and he wanted to get into the automotive industry.
Yeah.
So I kind of said, look, I'm struggling a bit. I'm busy trying to pay the bills now, but you're welcome to use it as a platform. And he was
That's right.
He was a young lad, so he was reviewing various kind of small cars.
Yeah, he was going on the, I remember he went on the Chevrolet Spark launch. And
yeah, like all of that stuff. Yeah. So I think there are maybe about 10 issues of it, but they were kind of very small, like 12-page each. Each thing was its own, each kind of feature was its own thing.
Yeah.
John, very sadly, not with us anymore.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that, I think maybe around the same time I was possibly doing the auto-tweet up Twitter stuff.
Of course. Another thing that you're known for and famed for within the automotive, the strange circle of automotive people, as in media creators, journalists, general creatives, I guess, is, yeah, auto-tweet up, which I didn't even write down because I completely forgot that that was a important thing. But that was quite cool, wasn't it? That was the first, certainly in my time working in this mad world, it was the first time I was able to get in a room with a collection of people who thought like I did, who had similar ambitions to me and who worked or wanted to work in the automotive industry. So those were quite cool events, weren't they? What was the reason behind coming up with it?
I'd been invited to an event by Auto Trader, which I think had been organised by John Quirk.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
And Auto Trader, and they wanted to do a Twitter meetup.
Right.
They called the event Auto Tweetup.
Right. Okay.
And so yeah, did the event, and I was kind of at after the event, like they didn't do any more with the name or anything like that. I left it a little while, but I just kept thinking that's a really, there's all these conversations going on Twitter. At the time you could only say 140 characters. Yeah. How do we kind of pull these kind of people who are writers, press people, marketing people, get them all together? So they can kind of continue these conversations. Mm. So I rather embarrassingly called it Auto Tweet Up. and it grew, and it's really cool now seeing some of the names of articles that have been written, seeing the people that were at that, or even just seeing where a lot of them have all gone now. You know,
yeah.
One of them, Keith, he was a teacher at the time. He was into cars.
Of course, yeah.
Now he's, he's a writer. I think he's still with Parkers.
He's with Parkers. Yeah. He's also one of the funniest men I follow on Instagram.
He's brilliant.
He's, Keith Jones.
Loads of people kind of started their journey there just through being able to network.
Yeah. So. I think that was a formative little chapter for me personally, because I was going along in like two capacities, really. I was going along as your mate, but also I was at that point realizing actually this mad corporate world that I've got myself caught up in isn't what I want to do. I was seeing people like yourself. I was seeing people like Keith. I was seeing people like John Slavin, even, who were at the beginning of their careers, all pursuing this thing that didn't really have a crib sheet. It wasn't like if you want to be a doctor, you go and study medicine and then you find your speciality and then you go and do a master's and then you go and do that. And it's all kind of like mapped out in the accordance of you do this to then do this and then you'll get access to that and then you'll end up being here. Within the creative realms of media, that doesn't exist. You kind of throw some sand in the air and go, see where it lands and see what happens. So it was quite powerful for me to be suddenly in these rooms with other people who were all quite similar going, yeah, I don't really know what the plan is, but we'll have a go at this and figure it out. And yeah.
Well, I think times were changing, you know, kind of 10 years prior, you would have said that you go and you start at a magazine, shuffling files, and then you might become like an assistant on something and then you work your way up through the ranks at a magazine. But technology was coming along. Brands wanted to start utilizing these different social platforms out there. And traditional journalists and that traditional route wasn't such a kind of path that you could take if you had ambitions to do something that's a bit more digital. So it was a kind of an interesting time for us all, really, that there was this kind of opportunity, and a lot of manufacturers were excited and trying to understand how they can leverage these kind of masses of people. It was good. We did some good events. You know, we had the We had one where Toyota brought along an LFA.
Yeah, and down in Sevenoaks in Kent.
Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff, and a couple of very messy ones in bars. We did the Coventry Motor Museum. We did the Great Escape Cars one where we all went out and driving cars
that's
for the
right.
day.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, there's some quite cool stuff. We did a few talks. Jim Cameron, a good friend of ours, came and gave a talk on Mission Motorsport. It was good. It was good fun. Nice group of people. Yeah.
Definitely. So I think the next chapter is the other bit where we started working together in a capacity where we suddenly found ourselves in an office at the same time. And that chapter is a fairly big one with Gumball 3000. There were a few road trips before. There were plenty that came after. But the Gumball chapter is, I think, one where we got to know each other the best, I think is probably the best way of saying it, in terms of working with each other, living with each other for a bit, and then starting to travel the world with each other. But we'll get to that very shortly, because I'm just going to cut to an advert break. So not much of a cliffhanger, because the advert's going to be about 30 seconds, and then people will come back and just carry on listening. But here's an advert break, and when we come back, we'll talk about what happened next. And then, of course, we're going to build up to what you're doing now, which is the important bit. Communications director for a super hypercar brand.
Hypercar, hyper. Yes. Danish hypercar.
At what point do we go mega, though? Is it going to be a mega car?
Mega car is... It's when it's a megawatt of power, which I think is over 1360 brake. So you could say they are mega cars, because the 1850 brake is the most powerful one.
Well, more on that shortly.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Driven Chat Podcast.
And we're back in the room. So, late 2012. By this point, you and I, Tim, have attended multiple events together. We have started talking about the idea of possibly working together, not really knowing how that would be or how it would pan out. You, at this point, had sent me on my very first press launch. So, in fact, we had started working together, but in a very casual capacity. Can you remember what the very exciting press launch that you sent me on was? I'll give you a clue. It was in the UK, but it was in a different country. In Wales, starting at the St. David's Hotel in Cardiff.
So I reckon that was probably Peugeot.
It was a Peugeot, yes. First car launch I ever went on, courtesy of you, Tim Hutton, was a Peugeot 308 CC, I think it was, convertible coupe.
Yeah.
So I don't think I've ever publicly thanked you for that opportunity. So let me put it on the record now.
Yeah, well, I think I would have to thank Anne-Marie Payne for that.
Aha.
Because through the auto tweet-ups, one of the PR companies coming along, they were doing work with Peugeot.
Yes.
And I think it came from that. We became friends, and I think she gave us a chance to get out on that.
Yeah.
I was like, this is too big for me. Who can I hand this over to? Wales in a convertible. It's got John written all over it.
Yeah, it certainly did. Yeah. But yeah, that was my first ever car launch.
Nice.
Was, yeah, it was great.
Mm, well, I only take the really good ones for myself, yeah. Unfortunately.
Meanwhile, Tim was in Monaco with Land Rover. No, that was that was quite a funny thing. So yeah, we'd started working with each other, doing bits and pieces. I was writing terribly for magazines, and then we were doing bits on and off. That was the other big formative one, wasn't it? Was Classic Grand Touring, which was a key chapter for both of us.
Yeah,
a company that later in life I'd end up being a director of and running. But as a lowly freelancer trying to work my way and worm my way into any form of creative automotive career through written words, photography, video bits or events, because that seemed to be the one thing that I was actually any good at, found myself doing bits and pieces of work. You had a great friend called Tom Brimblecombe, who later became a great friend of mine. Tom was running Classic Grand Touring and was running events too, Le Mans Classic. So I think the first time that we, beyond the Nürburgring, spent any time together outside the UK in and around cars was at Le Mans Classic, and we got on fairly well and got to know each other fairly well. And I think it was at that point that we decided, oh, actually, we quite like each other and this is fine and we probably will end up working together. But then fast forward another couple of years, a bit like your phone call back in 2005 from somebody saying, I've just been having a chat with Maximilian Cooper at Gumball 3000 and there's a role that might be good for you. I vividly remember the phone call from you in 2012 saying, I'm going to go back to Gumball and do some graphic design work. And I've just been having a chat with Max and he wants a new events guy. And I've put your name forward. Fast forward another week or two and I'm having a couple of conversations with Maximilian Cooper and his sister, Lucinda, who also worked for the company at the time. And then, yeah, before we know it, I'm the new events coordinator at Gumball 3000 and Tim Hutton's the graphic designer. There we are in the same office together on Latimer Road.
Yeah, you you started before me.
Yeah, that's right, just.
Yeah, because I was in talks with Max for quite a long time. I had just left my first wife and wanted to do something wild again. And
the answer was Gumball.
And the answer was Gumball, yeah. I do have to say a huge thank you also to Tom Brimblecombe for opening my eyes up to epic road trips,
yeah.
And just getting me hooked on driving around Europe, and or some of the trips that I did with him just really made me realize how much more you can see in a car, mm-hmm. going to places around Europe and how accessible it actually is. So yeah, a big thank you to him for that. Yeah, I think it was probably early in the new year that I finally started.
Yeah, it was. So I was having talks the end of 2012. I think we might have just started in 2012. But yeah, it was 2013 that we were both commuting to the office together.
Yeah, well, I was living in Milton Keynes for a bit.
That's right.
Well, yeah, I was living in Milton Keynes, and then I was driving down every morning, but to beat the traffic, I was leaving crazy early.
Yeah.
I think you've got pictures of me asleep in a Honda CRX Del Sol.
Correct.
Outside the office.
Which I kindly put online, and people assumed that you were just sleeping in the office car park,
yeah.
all night, which of course wasn't the case.
John has a hidden folder of some quite awkward stuff of me, like being folded in half on an electric bed in Germany as well.
Yeah, it's true.
So, yeah, I was living in Milton Keynes with a good mate, and you basically said, you can stay at mine midweek because the room's free during the weekdays.
That's right, yeah.
So, we started realising quite how much our musical tastes crossed over,
mm-hmm.
How our sense of humours were so well matched.
Read into that how you will, but terribly dark.
Yes.
I think is the gist.
Yeah. Those drives in, it was probably like an 8-mile drive, which would take an hour and something.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Well, yeah. I worked out early on that I could spend an equal amount of time either sitting on the tube and waiting for different tube trains or just sitting in my own car, which was mental to drive from the London Borough of Merton to Notting Hill. It's daft. That is a really, really daft commute. But it was the same time, and it just came to, we just realised, well, we'd rather sit and enjoy listening to music we like and having terrible conversations in a car than doing something similar on the tube, because we'd probably been arrested.
No, it was, they were hilarious drives in. I remember us stealing our breakfast from the Tesco's quite often.
Accidentally.
Yeah, no, bollocks, forgot to pay again. we had many, many laughs, which was very good, and it helped set you up for a day of utter madness that was a day in the office at Gumball.
Yeah, yeah, and it's something we've skirted around a few times before. There's an episode very similar to this one, actually, that I recorded with Sam Moores, who also has a very nice podcast, and Sam, of course, was one of the official photographers for Gumball, and we painted a bit of a picture there in the giving the reality to, yes, whilst there is this hugely glamorous, international, rock star-fueled, amazing event that goes on, the actual machine behind it isn't quite as glamorous as that big final result. So, yeah, working in the office certainly had its rewards. You know, I was off doing recces and I was planning routes, and you know, there was a lot of traveling and it was very exciting, but there were some challenging aspects to that job as well, which I think is no secret. I think anyone that's worked in a similar field of events or creative media will know that the final glossy result of what we all work to produce doesn't necessarily reflect the environment in building it.
It's very much a swan, that business.
Yes.
And we were very much underwater.
We were the feet.
Flapping around like crazy. And I think that is, a bit of it is Max's hyper creativity.
Yeah, massively.
And a bit of it is just the fact that you're trying to work out how to get 120 plus cars around 7 or 8 countries and dealing with countries, councils, everything all around, trying to get permissions. Like, it's a huge, huge thing to pull off and set up, and just how far barriers need to go from start lines.
Mm-hmm.
It just was a huge job, very big job for you. I just came in and just designed some t-shirts and things every day. But it was massive. I think the biggest issue really was Max is very creative at night, so didn't always come into the office before 4 p.m. and then would kind of be like, right, let's go through the grid.
We're doing this today.
And we're all kind of halfway out of the door.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a bit of that.
But it was great fun. Absolute madness. That pub down the road with Ducatis just parked in it.
Yes.
And if you ordered a whiskey and Coke, he'd just like reach behind him and get an open bottle of Coke that was totally flat.
What was that pub called? But yeah, you're right. It was, I don't think, maybe it didn't even have a name, because I think we'd walked past it a few times, and it was, I mean, this is the madness of that organization to work for. So Gumball in itself is a rock and roll event, but the office itself was quite quirky and quite cool, because three doors down on Latimer Road was Damon Albarn's recording studio.
Yeah.
So you'd see massive recording artists just like rolling in and out. And then one day we see them going across the road into this pub that looked like it used to be a pub, and now it was just kind of like a derelict building. But as we found out, it was a pub. But yeah, we could go in there. And the bloke, the landlord, who from memory was quite an eccentric Greek guy, used to keep his motorcycles in the pub because that was the safest place to park them. So he was using the pub as a garage, but it was still a pub. I remember one of the guys that worked on the apparel team, Neil, asking the landlord, oh, can we smoke in here? Because the landlord was lit up a cigarette, and the landlord just looked across and went, not officially, and then threw him a lighter. I just thought, what a cool place. What an amazingly cool pub.
Yeah, they just had to get lucky with finding a day when you decided to unlock the door, really. And some days the door was unlocked, but you'd still stand there for 10 minutes before anyone appeared. But
Yeah, it was good fun. Polish truck drivers fighting outside. kids breaking into cars to steal gumball caps.
Yeah.
There was that day when that guy who owned a football club was MOTing all his cars down the road.
And yeah, that's right. Throughout like 250 Lusos and stuff are rolling through.
250 Luso, yeah, 288 GTO, F40, just...
Yeah.
All, well, I think we were looking out the window just going, what is going on
What is going on?
And I think and we went down. Us. Yeah. Yeah. So it was good fun.
Yeah. And that was just the stuff that happened in London. And all the stuff that happened to the rest of the world. Well, that is someday a podcast in itself, which I think is the same conclusion I came to with Sam when we were talking. Because you can easily fall down a rabbit hole of just mad stories about Gumball. But it was good. You stuck around for another year or so, didn't you? And then I, for whatever crazy reason, stuck around for about three more.
Before I decided
that was enough.
I think nearly getting carjacked in Poland.
Oh, yeah.
Put me off.
And to hear that story again, I'm sorry, it's going to be a future one. I think what we should probably do at some point is try and get you, me, Sam Moores, maybe Max, if he's up for it, all around the table and just share some of these mad stories. Because, of course, Gumball lives on. It's still going. But I do feel like we were part of it at a time that was quite... it was like the second wave of madness, I think, from the initial start.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there are some good stories to be told. But, yeah, following that time, so you once you decided, okay, that's enough, mad chapter done, you went back into the world of publishing and started creating other magazines. And then by proxy, we started doing more road trips together, which were quite cool. And we were just in our little advert break reeling off some of the adventures that we've done, which one included driving a Nissan GTR to Verona to have a pizza and then drive home, which we did via the Alps. Mm-hmm. We took a GT86 to the Nürburgring. We've taken lots of cars to the Nürburgring. We drove a Bentley Bentayga about 4,000 miles.
All around Europe.
Yeah. All around Europe.
All to the most expensive places.
Yeah.
And there were four of us, so I had to pay for two rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a big trip.
That was.
I mean, there have been so many. I dread to think, I'd love to, maybe we'll work it out someday, but I'd love to work out the amount of miles that you and I have shared together on the road. It must be... tens and tens and tens of thousands. It has to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we drove my old Porsche 911 to Zagreb and back.
We did. Yeah, we did.
And on day one of that, I insisted that I drove the Porsche around the GP circuit of the Nürburgring.
Yes.
And cook the brakes.
I said, please don't take the car out before our rally because you'll cook the brakes.
Yeah.
And then you came in and went,
yep,
I've cooked the brakes.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that engine launched itself just as we were both happily driving along with our headphones on through France.
It did. Home. We made it onto the ferry,
and
it is the one and only time, I hope, in my life that I will push a car through passport control, which is exactly what we did.
Well, it was pretty horrible because they wouldn't have let us on the ferry if we had to push it on.
That's right, yeah.
So we had to jump...
It kind of cranked its way on, and then I was driving it on a bit on the starter motor, and it was not ideal.
No, poor thing.
Yeah. This was a 1976 Carrera SC.
Mm.
Just to paint that picture for you, dear listener.
Yeah, and that was the first private motor club project car.
Of course, which is the other big brand that I think a lot of people listening will know you for.
Yeah.
So Private Motor Club magazine, as it started...
Yeah, well, so I was working in a design agency and I really wanted to do a magazine. Actually, I started working on the magazine idea and then took a job in London working for another design agency doing more car stuff, cool things for Jaguar and Land Rover. And the magazine concept was called Superlux.
That's right.
And I did a crowdfunding for that. And someone that I'd met on the Gumball before messaged and said, love the idea. How much do you need? And we started chatting and formulating a plan. And we were going to do it in line with the agency I was working at, we all flew out to Cannes to meet this guy and sat on the beach and had lunch, and it was all pretty fancy. But then the conversation kind of stopped, and the agency wanted loads and loads of money to do it. And I went and sat and had a cigar with the investor, and we decided to go it alone.
Yeah.
And that was when Private Motor Club was founded, which I think was 2016.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah, and that was the beginning of, yeah, the real epic road trips and producing a magazine or journal that had just really epic features.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder why magazines don't have just pages after pages of epic features. It's because they cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
But they aren't half good fun to do. So it was a learning curve, and would do things differently now. Could be way more streamlined with your budgets, but it was an amazing experience with the cars and the people and the travel.
Yeah. Yeah, we had some good fun.
Really good. Yeah. It's yeah, I think our first big road trip was the Golden GTR.
It must be, yeah.
We stopped and we ate breakfast on the back wing outside the racetrack in Rome.
Yeah, Ringu. Yeah. Got all these photos, need to dig them all out now.
Yeah. But the Bentley Bentayga one was the most epic because we were producing a film.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was, we think we drove to Cannes and then to Monaco, then Portofino.
The route for the Bentayga?
Yeah.
London to Rheims.
Oh, yeah.
Rheims to Monaco.
Yeah.
Monaco to Milan.
Did we go to Milan first or Portofino first?
I think it was Milan and then to Portofino.
Okay.
Then to Bruno. Was it Bruno? The top of the Stelvio Pass.
Yeah, somewhere up there.
And then back to London.
Yeah.
For a 5-minute film.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long were we on the road? I feel like it was 2 weeks. It can't have been. It must have been a week.
No, it wasn't two. I think it was maybe like 8 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. 4 of us, 2 film guys.
Mm.
Luke and Vince.
Luke and Vince. Luke, who I should point out, is still works with me. And if you watch our YouTube content, you will know Luke's work because he's still doing what he does, making car films and flying amazing drone footage. So yeah, it's a small little circle of creative people that we know, isn't it?
Yeah, they were. I think I pitched the idea to them and said I can cover expenses. So if you want to treat it like a bit of a holiday and an adventure,
yeah,
then go for it. And then Vince got busy with proper film work. And then Al Clark very kindly stepped in and did
the final edit, yeah.
Which he's a top chap for doing that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a cool, thing. But it was that realization that actually you could chuck so much money at things for YouTube, but they'd rather see somebody trip over a shoelace.
Exactly.
And that was kind of a bit depressing for me.
Yeah, it is. It's an ongoing frustration with people creating automotive media. You have to be making something really quite incredible to be getting the footage. Otherwise, yeah, your arty film is, for whatever reason, looked at by the masses as, oh, why would I watch that when I can watch somebody's filmed it on a GoPro and an iPhone, which is internally frustrating, but eternally frustrating, as to say. But that's life, unfortunately. That's the lesson we learned.
Yeah. Yeah. So the magazine went on until 2020 or 21.
Mm-hmm.
It peaked a bit in pandemic. I think our second to last issue had a BMX on the cover that we had built from scratch.
Yes.
Painted like a Diablo with Diablo wheels. And we sold that bike to a French guy for £4,000.
Wow.
And that was good fun. There were some good projects with Private Motor Club. But with the pandemic, ad revenue just dropped off the cliff.
Mm.
And I needed to start looking for a proper job again. And then I got headhunted to go and work for Classic Driver as their managing editor, which is a really great European website covering classic car culture. And I don't know how long I did with them, but
it was a good stint.
Yeah, a couple of years maybe.
Yeah.
And then I just felt I needed a break from it all. Kind of was wary of my mental health. And decided to move to Portugal for 3 months.
Which was nice.
Yeah. And while I was out there, I met up with an old mate called Jens.
Yep. Hello, Jens.
Who I've known for 10 years. I met him 2013 Gumball, because I ran the press, I ran the checkpoint at the Koenigsegg factory.
Uh-huh.
So while you were jetting off down towards the border to get stuck at a border somewhere.
Jetting off in a Nissan Qashqai. I wish I was joking.
Yeah. I was meeting Jens, and we kept in touch ever since. So while I was living out in Portugal, we just met up for lunch. And over the course of the lunch, he just said, I could do with somebody like you on the team at Zenvo. And then showed me the new car that they're working on his phone. And it looked mega.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, yeah, I'm in. And that's what I've found through life, really, is that you just, the stuff just comes to you if you kind of put yourself out and, like I said earlier, get on and do the things that you enjoy.
It does.
If you stay indoors waiting for the phone to ring, it's not. But if you just crack on and do what you love, the good stuff kind of comes to you, I think.
It's very true. And I think, like you said that very kind thank you to Tom Brimblecombe earlier as the kind of person that perhaps turned on that little light bulb of this is what cars can be, i.e. driving around the world on these road trips and doing other bits and pieces. And I think I kind of need to extend a massive thank you to you for doing the same to me in regards to what you've just said, essentially, which is that because I never really, like so many of us and so many of our listeners right now will have, I'm sure, this ongoing thought at the back of their mind whilst working in a job that perhaps they don't love, or looking at this industry that they'd like to be more involved in and thinking, well, I want to do more with that. So in our sense, cars and motorbikes and travel, but I don't really know how to do it, or at what point somebody taps you on the shoulder and goes, right, that's it. This is it. This is the opportunity, because that doesn't ever happen. But if you keep following that pursuit, and I think that's exactly what I ended up doing with you, it was kind of taking on these opportunities. If something would crop up of, oh, do you want to drive a Nissan GTR to Italy for a pizza and back? Then of course the answer was going to be yes. And okay, I know that that's not the kind of offer that people often get presented with. And, you know, it comes with other caveats, like you're going to have to fund it yourself, or, you know, at least look after your own food and drink. You're going to have to take a couple of weeks off work to do it, which might eat into what would have been a holiday, that sort of stuff. But you have to grab all these opportunities. And I think that's what you and I have always been very good at doing, is kind of not necessarily identifying what's an opportunity at any given time, but just going, oh, that'd be fairly cool. And then by doing that fairly cool thing, you meet other fairly cool people who think in a similar way and do things in a similar way. And it all does just fall into place. And it's often not until after stuff's happened that you think back and go, oh, that was the opportunity there. You know, there wasn't a big A4 piece of paper saying, this is it, this is the day. It was just a collection of, in some cases, some very stressful, very difficult, ambitious working environments or chancer environments that then lead to these massive opportunities. So there you are in Portugal on a little holiday, not a holiday as such, but having a little break from the reality that is the UK. You meet Jens. Jens says, oh, I'm looking after this company called Zenvo now. And give it a few months, you're the communications director for Zenvo.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he kind of tasked me with stuff straight away just to start thinking about bits and pieces, just kind of reviewing the social media content and just, start looking at some strategy and just all of the kind of things that are outwardly facing with the brand and stuff like that.
Mm.
And just kind of how we would lead our way up to revealing these new cars to the world, which we did in August this year at the Quail during Monterey Car Week. So yeah, I think by October it was official.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been an awesome journey so far. It's a cool car, great team, and I love the design of it, the kind of Danish design philosophy behind it. Just produced a really good looking car.
Mm.
And then powered by a 6.6 litre V12 quad turbo engine.
That'll do it.
Yeah, so Mahle Powertrain are our engine partners. And like Mahle as a group actually own Cosworth. So
yeah, of course.
Huge company. You'll see their logo on the Ferrari Formula One cars.
Yeah.
They were really excited when we started talking to them about the engine, because it's not often that new engines get built these days.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think we were looking at a twin turbo engine, but when they started to kind of run some figures and do some kind of just computer figures and things, actually quad turbo made more sense. And quad turbo just sounds awesome.
It does sound pretty cool.
Sounds crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, the idea with Aurora is that it is this equilibrium of extremes. So we're not going out there to be the fastest car. We're not going out there to be the electric hypercar. We're not going out there to be one thing better than anything else, because there's always somebody who's going to come along a couple of months later and go faster around the Nürburgring or get a higher top speed. So why risk compromising the car just for one thing?
Mm, yeah, too right.
And I think, you know, now people just appreciate more and more just having an engaging analog feeling car. So that's why we've really made sure that it's kind of got this great balance across the whole car of how it feels to drive. The power, you know, there's plenty of power there, but it's not the most powerful.
Yeah.
And that was very important when we were kind of figuring it all out with the cars. Likewise, the interior, you won't see a big screen in there. The analog dials actually rotate with the screens.
Cool.
For all of the engine management and CarPlay behind it. So when you're sat in it, it feels like a kind of 90s supercar.
Nice.
And you can focus on the driving. There's not a big bright screen making you squint or anything like mm-hmm. that. It's really, really cool thing. Really excited to be part of it. The engine, we will hopefully fire up for the first time spring next year.
Very cool.
That is going to be a big, big day. We've all seen the car now and we love it. And now we want to hear it.
Definitely.
And then, towards the end of the year or throughout the year, we'll start working on getting that engine into a mule car.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure we keep all of the mule cars, because I think...
Yeah,
I love all of that. It always breaks my heart when people have destroyed these mule cars afterwards. so they'll all have Danish names, I'm sure. Production starts 2025, which sounds a long way away, but equally...
Essentially, it's next year, isn't it?
Which is really...
By the time this goes out.
Yeah, it's kind of terrifying as well.
Yeah.
So...
Talk to me then about that conversation with Jens initially of like, do you want to come and be part of this? Because that must have been quite one of those surreal moments in the career. If you imagine life as a book or career as a book, suddenly this next chapter comes along. It's, you know, been doing event bits and pieces, some graphic design work, some publishing work. And now suddenly it looks like I'm about to be a head of communications for an automotive brand. That must have been like, did it feel daunting? What was your sort of perception of the brand at that point in comparison to once you were in for a few months?
it wasn't too daunting because I I didn't know loads about Zenvo. I'd seen them at Salon Privé and I'd seen them at Geneva Motor Show and things like that over the years. The car that they had looked cool. But they weren't a huge company, so compared to McLaren or something like that.
Of course.
If I'd been offered the role of director of communications for McLaren, I would have been, very, very concerned that I'd be able to manage that, because that's a huge global company with multiple dealerships all around the world. But, you know, Zenvo is an artisan producer of hypercars. They were producing kind of 4 cars a year, and with Aurora, we'll start leveling that up, obviously. So there wasn't, I was kind of confident I could go into the role and not be overwhelmed straight away with learning some of the new things I needed to learn. I just kind of eased into it relatively smoothly. And
I guess at the dawn of a new car, a new chapter for the brand, it's kind of perfect, isn't it? Because you can outline what you feel is going to be good, and without having to feel like you're copying the work of others or learning from the crib sheet of a car that's already been on the market for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. The hardest stuff really is kind of getting up to speed with all of the older product, because the team that Jens has built now is very much about the new car, but we still need to talk, and you can still buy the existing car as well. So I just need to get up to speed with understanding that car and the journey of the company and the history and things, because they've been around since 2007.
Yeah.
That was when the company was very first founded. They've had a long journey, but they've always kind of just kept themselves to a set size and not tried to kind of expand too quick and try and build loads and loads of cars. But the factory is really cool. You'll have to come out there.
Yeah,
when we do something next year, and like the carbon work, it's just insane.
Yeah.
Hypercars, I'm never likely to own a hypercar, but I love how customizable they are
and
how personal they can be. And the buyers that we have are very much self-made people that are there. They don't want to have a car that everyone else has got. They want to have something that has their personality in it. And with these kinds of cars, when you're spending towards $3 million, you can do whatever you want. If you've got your son's favorite color t-shirt that you want the interior to be, do anything, have images put into the carbon, signatures, names, anything at all, really. Tints of paint over the carbon, colored lacquer on the carbon. Like, it's crazy. So one of the fun things is just having to play on the configurator that we've got and watching all the customers during Monterey Car Week sat there. It's kind of normally like up to a 2-day thing if you're there with your partner, just going through the car, having these discussions.
Which I feel like when you're spending that sort of money on something as special as that, it kind of warrants it, doesn't it? To be able to create something on the configurator, go away for a bit, have a little think, then come back and go, oh, actually, maybe lime green wheels wasn't the choice. Being able to make those arrangements is pretty cool.
Yeah, buying these kinds of things, the whole journey needs to be an adventure from the day that you start looking into it and start configuring it right until you get the keys, and then you're in the Zenvo family then anyway, so you're always going to be part of us after that. But it's important to kind of keep the customer engaged in that journey, because we don't build these cars in a week. So
no, of course.
That's one of the next things that we'll be looking at next year, is just how we engage the customer. Some nice little things that they'll receive throughout the course of the year, or when they kind of pay the next stage of their deposits and things. That's a really exciting part of the job, is the commercial partnerships that we have and that we have talks going on about with watch brands and clothing and Ooh. And that side of things. I enjoy that. It's mm. got, it's got a good variety of the job.
Yeah, I can imagine. And the customers that are coming forward that are expressing interest or putting down deposits, what are they like? Are they people that already own a collection of hypercars? Are there people that this will be their first hypercar? Is there a typical example of a customer?
We're not Pagani or Bugatti. We haven't been producing cars for as long as they have. Mm. So we're generally not going to be the very first hypercar people buy for most of the customers.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them it is because they've seen it and they're moving a few things around and they're making money, so the space for it, and they want it and they completely get it and they just love the sound of that engine.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the majority of the customers though have every hypercar.
Wow.
And it will be more like, okay, April 2026, I've got a gap in the deliveries of cars. Gosh. Can you get me a car for them? So those are more often than not the conversations you're having. Is they're getting a Utopia 1 month and then they want something else the next month. Wow. And it's a different world, but I quite like that because it doesn't impact on my interest of cars, which thanks again to Thomas, is kind of veering towards classic cars.
Yeah.
So my previous job at Classic Driver was starting to impact a bit on my passion.
Yes.
Because I was looking at all these cars for sale every day. I wanted to buy them all.
Mm.
And then by the end of the week, you don't really then want to do anything with your own classic car.
Mm-hmm.
With the hypercars, it's still interesting and cool when it's cars.
Yeah.
But it's not a world I'm ever going to be in.
Sure.
So that means I can enjoy when it works, my Jaguar at the weekends and things. So I think that's quite important. You can be a bit too close to the kind of work life thing sometimes. The $3 million hypercars, I understand them and I know about them, but it's not likely to be in my garage anytime.
No. And that's, I think, probably a good thing in the sense of having that separation from desire to having that appreciation of what they are and why people buy them and why people love them so much.
Mm.
You can still share that passion, but without that spoiler. What's the old analogy? If you work in a cake shop, eventually you will get sick and tired of cakes. And I think the same can be said for a lot of the automotive industry as well. If we indulge ourselves too much in a relatable, accessible world, it suddenly feels a lot like work, and that's when things aren't as fun.
Yeah, you say that, but I was a pizza boy and I still love pizza. In fact, apart from my job now, obviously at Zenvo, which is the best job I've ever had, being a pizza boy was probably the second best job.
Was it really?
Yeah. Getting your knee down on mopeds every night with your mates, delivering to women in dressing gowns who were maybe wanting more than pizza.
Really?
Getting tips and free pizza.
It was like, wow.
I don't know. It ticked a lot of boxes.
I love the comparison.
Yeah.
Would we rather be communications director for a hypercar brand or a pizza delivery boy? Both about the same.
I think I think muck jobs are environments where you make really great friends because you know that the job is perhaps not the best job in the world, but you all kind of pull together. And so that kind of banter, if you want to call it that, is just unrivaled.
Yeah, that's very true, actually. Thinking back on some of the in-between jobs that I had whilst pursuing the wider, this is what I want to do for a living. Still got a lot of really close friends that I've worked with in call centres and random event companies dotted around the world, which is quite cool. And travel. Yeah, big stints in travel.
Yeah.
So knowing what you know and the life that you've lived and career that you've had so far, what would you say are kind of some of the most formative chapters, the stuff that you perhaps look back on now, because I've certainly found myself doing this, now that I've got to a point where I've done quite a few different things in the automotive world, I look back on things that I did maybe 5-10 years ago and think, God, I wouldn't have even imagined that this little bizarre thing I was doing was become such a formative chapter towards future things. So is there anything like that stands out for you that at the time you wouldn't have even given it a second thought, but now you look back on and go, God, that was actually an amazing thing?
Yeah, I think, so when I left the first design agency job and went freelance, I went along to a car show at Earls Court called MPH.
Mm-hmm.
And at that show, Intersection magazine had a stand, and I went over and I said, I love your mag. Like, I buy all the copies when I can find it, 'cause it's mm-hmm. quite hard to find. Would love to work for you sometime. And that was how I got the call from Yorgo to say, come and work.
Yeah.
So if I hadn't bothered going to that show, would never have worked for Gumball, would never have met the person that invested in Private Motor Club,
mm-hmm.
would never have met Jens, and wouldn't be at Zenvo now.
Yeah.
So if I'd had a cold that day, then I've no idea what I would be doing now.
It's funny, isn't it, that, yeah, you have those thoughts? Because I've had the same thought about the random trip that I would have gone on with Al to the Nürburgring. That wouldn't have been a paid gig. That would have been Al saying, I'm going to the Nürburgring to do this and this and to meet this guy. Do you want to come? And whether or not I had some days off in the week or days in lieu or whatever it would have been, a long weekend, and just went, yeah, I'll do that. I'll come along. And there we are standing in a Nürburgring car park going, John, meet Tim. Tim, meet John. It's funny, isn't it? These little moments. So I guess the moral of that story then for you, dear listener, is if these opportunities come up to experience something, to try something, or if you've got this desire to go and indulge in your passion that maybe one day could be a career, it's probably worth showing up.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I always, if anyone ever kind of asks me for advice or anything, I try and help, because I know that we're all in that same point. Once definitely, before, yeah. It's like when you've got a great press car and somebody's looking at it, you always kind of let them have a sit in it.
Oh, God, yeah, because absolutely.
Those are the memories that we hold of, like, sitting in these amazing cars and things as kids, yeah. And that can set you off on a path in life. So, yeah, it's much easier to be nice to people as well.
It is, yeah. As much as other people would try to convince you otherwise, it really is the case. Be a nice person, be interesting, be interested. The rest is easy.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. Well, this has been quite nice, isn't it?
Very pleasant. Yeah.
Very pleasant. We've worked through. I'm glad, actually, because I've learnt certain things that I didn't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I think maybe I did know about the Pizza Boy chapter, but yeah, lots of things I didn't know.
Yeah, didn't cover hitting a deer in a Citroen AX GT driving to work.
That's true. You also didn't mention the time that you were driving a Lexus that had a very distinctive mark on the boot.
Yeah.
When a horse tried to eat it.
Yeah, the moral of the story is, if you live by the sea, wash your car a lot, because it gets very salty.
Uh-huh.
And horses like salt, and if they lick salt on your Lexus, we'll try and eat it. So yeah, yeah. And the deer, by the time I got to work, I think the Citroen AX GT came off worse than the deer. It's made of French paper.
Yes.
By the time I got to work, I told my boss, and with a very serious face, he said that I needed to call the police and tell them. And I was really, really nervous and called the police and said, oh, I think I hit a deer on the way into work. And they were like, and?
Cool.
yeah, no, there's probably many, many silly things that I've done.
That's the joys of life, though, isn't it? And the great thing is there'll be many more.
There'll definitely be many more silly things, yeah.
Yeah.
And all the stuff that can't be spoken about publicly will all go in a book at some point.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
Yeah.
Ideally published about a week or two before we die.
I think I'll probably just leave it somewhere in a lockup with a key for afterwards.
That should be the title of the book.
Yeah.
For afterwards.
Yeah, for afterwards. Yeah.
There will be many stories for sure.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Tim. It's been a bit of fun working through the career. I am genuinely really excited to see what happens with the new Aurora. So you say the mules, hopefully about this time next year, towards the end of 2024.
Yeah, so we'll fire up the engine, and then from there we'll probably look to get some form of car, like an Ultima or something, that we can get the engine in and just start putting miles on it.
Yep.
Unfortunately, we probably won't have anything like that operational before Goodwood Festival of Speed, which will be the first proper chance for people in the UK to see the Aurora models. But yeah, by this time next year, we'll be putting mileage on the engine, which is really, really cool.
Very cool. So yeah. Potentially Festival of Speed 2025, we might see a car up the hill.
We might have something going up the hill, maybe in some camo. Well, I don't need it to be in camo, because I don't think we're going to change the car a whole lot from the concept, because for the current concepts, we did foam models, and the designers have already made certain tweaks. There will be a few things that change, obviously, but we've very much designed the car with global homologation in mind. Ingress, egress, our chief designer, Christian Brandt, is a very, very tall Danish man. And so there was absolutely no chance of him not being able to fit in the car.
Cool.
So we've done a lot of the stuff that maybe some companies would go out and make a really cool looking concept and then be like, can't actually do that.
Yeah, yeah.
We did a lot of that. And I think that's that kind of Danishness of just working through things very methodically and being precise about stuff. Doing it properly. So yeah, next year is going to be really exciting, and a big schedule of travel and sharing these cars all around the world as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's a big part of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Exciting stuff. Well, can't wait to see more. Well, thank you. It's been good fun.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I've remembered things I'd forgotten, so it's good.
The dangerous thing about this podcast malarkey is you end up remembering things and going, oh Christ, I've not spoken to that person for a while, but check they're still alive. Anyway, speaking of being still alive, this podcast is, but only just, because as you may be aware, talking to you now, dear listener, we are bringing this particular podcast to an end. Big shock horror for those that haven't been listening to the most recent episodes. Yep, we're drawing this one to an end, but we are carrying on in the new year, probably late winter, early spring, with a new chapter for Driven and for our podcast. So for all the details of that and the nitty-gritty and the information, just have a look at the website, driven.site, and keep an eye on our social feeds as well. You'll see all the information you need to know about that big change there. For now, I will say thank you very much for listening. Do listen out for another episode in about a week's time, because I have a feeling it's going to be quite a major one with a fairly significant title. So keep an eye on that. Thank you so much for listening. We shall speak to you again next week.
The Driven Chat Podcast, powered by Paramex Digital.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh, wow, you've made it to the end, the very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat Podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven Podcast in your preferred podcast app, or head on over to the website, driven.site, to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.